Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Leaders in Supply Chain podcast. I am your host, Radu Palamariu, Managing Director of Elcott Global. And it's my pleasure to have with us today Thierry Malheret, who is the Managing Partner of the Monthly Barometer, which is one of the leading global monthly newsletters that distills into a highly analytical and predictive one-pager the macro issues relevant to executives and decision makers across the world. And previously, Thierry founded and headed the Global Risk Network at the World Economic Forum. As well as in his professional experience, he held key positions within investment banking across several global institutions. He was part of think tanks and academia, both in New York and Oxford. He had a stint in the government with a three-year spell in the Prime Minister's office in Paris. His latest book, co-authored with Charles Schwab, is titled COVID-19, The Great Reset. It's very much a great point of reference for the times that we live in. And it's going to be the main topic of our discussion today. So I'm really looking forward to sharing and finding out more from you, Thierry. So thank you very much for the time and welcome.
Thank you, Radu. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with a couple of pointers on the book, because I know that you spoke in the book about macro reset, which you and Charles mean to affect several areas, including economy, society, geopolitics, environment, and technology. And I'd like to double click first and foremost, maybe on the economic perspective, and maybe if you could tell us what you understand by the Great Reset in economy.
Right. So first of all, the book addresses the issue from a multiplicity of perspectives. And one of the very key points we make in the Great Reset is that you cannot look at the macro issues in isolation from each other. So in the macro big chapter of the book, we look at economics, geopolitics, societal issues, environment, tech. And the point, the very fundamental point we make is that all these five big macro issues are completely interdependent. They concatenate with each other. They amplify each other. So an economic risk is bound to have an impact on societal issues and vice versa. So when we talk about the big reset in economics, we start from the very simple observation that the pandemic is inflicting a very major shock on the global economy. It's a shock of unprecedented proportions for the past generations. The only, in terms of magnitude and breadth, the only comparable shock could be a world war, like World War II, even though the effects are very different. Because in the case of war, you emerge with your capital stock, physical stock, having to be rebuilt. And in the case of a pandemic, it's the opposite. In the labor, the human stock is in disarray and the capital stock is intact. So it's a massive shock. It's both a supply and demand shock, which is going to create tremendous consequences, first and foremost, in terms of unemployment. So it will affect very many people's lives around the world. It's going to have a great impact on growth, which we can already see, you know, around the world. Growth is falling precipitously in so many countries around the world. So the Great Reset means that national authorities everywhere, in every single country, because every single country has been impacted by COVID-19, whether it's a small country, whether it's a large country, every single one of them has been impacted. So how do you rebuild your economies in a post-COVID world? In the book, we argue that the reset is going to take the form of all the policies that are being put into place at the moment in terms of fiscal support, in terms of expansionary monetary policies, which are absolutely required to start again, to get the engine starting again. But what we argue, and this is what the Great Reset is all about, is that we cannot do things as before. Over the past decades, the economy, the global economy has grown in a very unequal and destructive way. Unequal because social inequalities have risen dramatically all around the world, and destructive in the sense that economic growth has taken place at the detriment of the environment. So it has had a very negative impact on what we call natural assets, in terms of air pollution, in terms of land pollution, in terms of global warming, etc. So the key argument of the book is that the Great Reset has to be executed in such a way that the global economy becomes more inclusive, more equal, So it will require that the social contract be rewritten in several countries around the world, and also much more respectful of Mother Nature. And we can discuss it a bit further during the podcast, but it's a fallacy to think that if we grow in a greener way, is going to destroy employment and destroy growth. You can have both. And at the moment, there are many initiatives around the world proving that growing your economy in a way that is respectful of nature is indeed possible.
Thanks for the overview. And these are big topics. And also, I will kind of build upon what you said and for making the point, which is extremely useful, that indeed all of these are very much interconnected. I will go, given the fact that, you know, we're kind of trying to bridge more on the business side, I'm double clicking on a few, but ultimately you cannot have one without the other. It's a very fine ecosystem, as you rightfully mentioned. And yeah, we're at this crossroads where pretty much, I think, whilst it has been overused in many aspects, this expression of the new normal or unprecedented times, depends on which one you prefer. It is true in a sense that things will not be back to how they used to be. And it's kind of up to us whether we want to take a conscious choice and action to make it different, or, you know, just kind of go with the flow, which may or may not work. So I also wanted to go into the geopolitics perspective, because we are seeing all sorts of things happening. It was happening already. The tensions in between China and the US were happening even before the pandemic. But how or what are some of the trends that you see from a geopolitics perspective as well, Thierry?
Well, Radu, the best way to understand how COVID-19, the pandemic, is making its way throughout macro issues is to see it as an amplifier of existing risks. So if you take economic risk, societal risk, technological risk, and geopolitical risk, you realize that the pandemic has had the effect of amplifying pre-existing trends. So in terms of geopolitical issues, there were problems before, you know, between the US and China. We saw them growing over the past few years or months. There were issues around the world due to the fact that global governance system is in complete disarray. There is no world leader anymore. There is very little, you know, agreement between countries and regions on how to move forward. In many ways, the world has been disunited. You know, we talk about UN, United Nations, but the world is fragmented very much at the moment. It's disunited with, you know, an explosion of identity politics around the world. You can see it, you know, in countries as different as Turkey, India, Russia, US. So every big country around the world is, almost every country, almost every big country around the world is retrenching at the moment. And this is a cause for concern. So what the pandemic has done, and it has done the same, you know, throughout the ages, every time there's been a major pandemic, whether it was the Justinian pandemic in the 6th century or the Great Plague in the 13th century and COVID today, it leads to a search for scapegoat. You know, that's how countries and human beings operate. When something goes wrong, we look for a scapegoat. And you can see it at the moment, most dramatically and most visibly, in terms of a relationship between the US and China. It's taken a very, very troublesome turn. There's been, you know, accusations from each side about the incompetence or malevolence of the other. For the first time ever over the past few weeks, analysts and even officials have been talking about a possible accident leading to a conflict, you know, localized or not, between China and the US. So these are very, very troubling times in geopolitical terms. And it's not only, you know, China and the US, of course, is the greatest game in the world today, because we're talking about two giants. But you can see similar issues in Europe. You know, in Europe at the moment, you have troubling developments in the Baltic regions. There was a comment made by the Swedish Minister of Foreign Affairs about a week ago saying that she was very troubled about some developments in the Baltic region, particularly with respect to Russia. There have been problems recently in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea between Turkey and Greece, which required the involvement of other countries. other European countries. There are problems, even something which is not very talked about, like the conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh between Azerbaijan and Armenia. There have been incidents recorded over the past few weeks. So what COVID has done is to fuel the pre-existing conflicts that existed before and bring them to the fore. And that's a very troubling development. And it's hard to think about what could alleviate this problem at the moment.
It's a little bit like putting fuel on the fire. And
absolutely. Absolutely. You're right. This is a correct image.
And how about technology? What does you speak about also the Great Reset in technology? Tell us a little bit about that from the book and from your perspective.
Well, in the book, we observe two things. First of all, COVID has boosted tech in a way that would have been unimaginable in the pre-COVID era. You know, everything has gone faster in terms of tech developments. The world has digitized at an incredible pace, and many, many developments that were not foreseen just a few months ago, 7 months ago when COVID started, have now happened. I can provide you with zillions of different examples, but telemedicine is the most vivid example. Telemedicine barely existed before COVID. It was an issue beset by regulatory problems. It was very hard to put into place. And almost overnight, telemedicine happened, thanks to COVID. So, at the moment, it's absolutely clear, I think, to everybody, to every industry, that if you are not digitizing your operations, you are in big trouble and bound to be dead in a few months or years from now. I mean, you cannot survive if your business is not digitizing, including in spaces that were unlikely to be seen as digitalizing, such as events and conferences. So it's happening everywhere. That's one observation. So tech is the unmitigated and very clear winner of COVID. On the other side, the way in which technology has been used to manage or COVID or to try to contain the epidemic is raising many concerns. Test and tracing technologies, apps, raise very fundamental questions about privacy, about surveillance and the way in which governments can intrude in our private lives. So it's very much something that is double-edged. On the one side, it's progressing fast, which is a good thing because it improves the way we operate and probably makes us more productive as a business. But there is also a more troubling aspect linked to the fact that it seems that many countries will now be using technology and surveillance systems to intrude in the life of the citizens.
Yeah, and obviously if some were already doing it and now it can be it can be, back to the analogy of accelerating the trend, it can be used as a very convenient reason or excuse to do it even more. From a micro, you also, what I liked about the book is that you then went into the micro reset. And you mentioned industries, you mentioned businesses and the impact of COVID-19 there, and specifically, and our audience obviously is mostly people that have to do with supply chain. You did mention a point there which was linked to resilient supply chains. And I wanted to ask you more, I guess there's a sub question in there, is if you see a trend of regionalization of supply chains and making it much more regional focus versus global focus that they used to be. And what's your, what's your views? And tell us more about that point.
Thank you, Radu. Yes, that's a perfect example of a macro issue, an industry issue, something that pertains to business operations being impacted by a geopolitical and economic trend. You remember that at the beginning of the pandemic, in the early months of the pandemic, particularly when it struck Europe, after Asia, after China, and Asia. So in March, April, there were dramatic problems of supply in Europe and most visibly in Italy. There were no PPE equipments, there were not enough ventilators, there were not enough antibiotics, etc. So everybody realized the extent to which highly developed economies were so dependent upon supply chains, in this particular case, supply chains from Asia. So the thinking at that time was that you need to replace efficiency, just-in-time supply chains, efficiency by resilient supply chains that might be less effective, more costly, but that can provide, you know, support when it is needed. So that's something that made the news almost every day. In March, in April, in May, you had, you know, a spate of articles, of analysis, of comments from policymakers due to the fact that everybody awoke to the reality that, for example, 90% plus of antibiotics being delivered in the US and most European countries come from Asia and India, East Asia and South Asia. So there was a complete rethinking among policymakers and business leaders saying, okay, what do we do now? How are we going to restructure our supply chain so that they can become more resilient in terms of crisis? Because of course, efficiency entails fragility. You know, everybody began to realize that when you have formidable, efficient system, it's also very fragile, but by definition, by necessity. So many businesses, many companies, many organizations, industries, and countries are now thinking about how to build more resilient supply chains, which I think entails a general shortening of supply chains. And it's already visible in the food industry for different reasons that have to do with environment. But, you know, now there is a growing realization that we must shorten supply chains in the food industry because it's better for the environment. So similarly, it's happening for the pharma industry, for, you know, other industries that were too reliant on just-in-time supply chains. And in the meantime, this phenomenon has also been accelerated by geopolitical issues. I don't have on top of my mind the number of regarding supply chain from China to the rest of the world by countries, but, you know, supply chain from Asia in general play a very critical role in the industry activity and manufacturing activity of most European and American companies. So how is this going to evolve in a world that is increasingly dividing along geopolitical lines? What's going to happen when President Trump decides that we shouldn't accept any more FDI from China or supplies from China in some specific sectors of the US economy, with similar issues now arising in Europe? So in this context of defiance, how is the global supply chain system going to adapt? What we observe in the book is that there is at the moment a phenomenon towards regionalization and sometimes localization. So because of this conflation of geopolitical and trade and economic issues, there is a very strong, powerful trend leading towards regionalization, with some blocks, regional blocks, trading between themselves increasingly. So it's something which is particularly evident in the EU, in ASEAN, in East Asia, in Mercosur. And I think it's going to be a trend that will strengthen over the coming years for all the reasons we just talked about.
I do remember speaking about healthcare specifically, I might not remember exactly the number, but it was somewhere like 90% of the antibiotics around there in the US are imported, and mostly from Asia or something to that extent.
Yes, from India, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, from India, yeah. So it's in an insane number if you put it into perspective, especially when COVID hits and, you know, your supply chain gets disrupted. So I would tend to agree that definitely, food and healthcare will be a particular area of bringing as close, if not in the country itself, but as close to the borders. But I'm just wondering, and I want to zoom in a little bit further, there's certain supply chains, for example, if we take technology, and I had this conversation with somebody on a panel recently, the supply chain for making a laptop, for example, right, the manufacturing of a laptop, because there's so many specialized parts, and also China did a very good job at creating this ecosystem, right, where it's, you know, on top of the fact that you have the plant, which I guess you can duplicate the plant somewhere else, right, you can put a manufacturing plant in Mexico or in Eastern Europe or Africa. But infrastructure to and from the plant, ports, that's not as easy as snapping a finger, plus the whole trade infrastructure, plus the laws, the regulations, the ecosystems, the finance, and so on. So I'm just wondering whether it's going to apply across the board, because certain supply chains are definitely much harder to move and put somewhere else than, and also you need the talent, right? You need the workforce that is specialized and knows how to produce certain things which may or may not be available and might need to be trained. So I'm just wondering if you also see distinction in between, you know, separate different industries being taking longer or shorter, or what's your thoughts just in general about this?
Well, Radu, I think you make a very important point, because we mentioned in the book that even though there is this willingness of policymakers to shorten dramatic supply chains and to reorient supply chains towards particular regions and even countries, it's going to be much more difficult than we think for the reasons you just mentioned. You know, you can't do it overnight. In the book, we give the example of Foxconn and in China, and that's exactly what you just said. You know, there were motorways built for the factories of Foxconn. There were airports built, ports, etc. So these are incredibly expensive infrastructure projects. And even if you were to decide that you bring them to an end, this will not happen overnight because there are massive capital expenditures required to do so. It's expensive and also it takes a lot of time. However, we believe, the book, Klaus and I, that the direction of the trend is clear. And it's going to the direction of shortening supply chains and makes them more regional. And we also provide examples to prove the point. You know, Japan, for example, has put aside some money to help Japanese industries to relocate in Japan and to fight supply chains in Japan. And there are similar examples that apply in many other countries around the world. So to respond to your question in just one sentence, it's not going to happen overnight. But the phenomenon is happening nonetheless, and the direction of the trend is clear.
On your second point, and you mentioned it also on the point of technology, acceleration of the digitization of industries, and this is a big point that you mentioned as a micro reset as well. And you more or less say there's going to be three main effects, and I just want to first start with the number one, which is the talent pool will become even more global, which will actually in turn push wages down and actually will further kind of have a consequence of basically, economically speaking, the way that some of the jobs will be even lesser paid. Tell us a little bit about that, because that, again, can cause some pretty significant issues in society and, well, economically and the broader scheme of things.
Yes. So this question of acceleration of digitization, we already discussed it. It's happening. It's going to develop even further. It's a global phenomenon, and it's impossible to imagine where it could stop. It's happening, and it's an absolute necessity, so it's going to be global. And the talent pool for digitization, for reasons that have to do with tech, is global. You can go anywhere. I can give my very own example. You know, I realized at the beginning of the pandemic that we're missing resources in terms of digital capabilities. So my colleague in charge of this said, at the moment, our resources are in France and in the US. So we looked for someone who could help us with a particular issue. And we had the choice between Ukraine, India, Pakistan, and the Baltics. So, and of course, these solutions are much less expensive than they are in France for reasons that have to do with economic development and standards of living. So, through my very small, tiny example at the level of my small business, I epitomize this trend. When you look for someone in the field of digital, you can go anywhere around the world because you don't need to meet in person. Everything is done on Skype, on Zoom, or whatever platform you prefer, whichever platform you prefer. So immediately the talent pool becomes global because any information about anything, any supplier can be found online. So it's a basic observation that it's happening. It's true.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then you mentioned two other effects of this digitization that has been accelerated. And by the way, I just found mind-blowing, and I want to add the data, just looking at e-commerce and the adoption of e-commerce, right, in terms of growth. I think it was a McKinsey report. In 3 months, the e-commerce adoption worldwide grew as much as it grew in 5 years.
Yes, it's crazy, unbelievable.
Yeah,
just.
Yeah. And it's just I don't think also we're gonna go back. The people that maybe were reluctant before this, and now you're stuck at home and you have no other choice but to order online, and then you figure out that it's quite convenient. And probably not going to go back to the supermarket after this whole thing ends, because it's a, behavior is hard to change because it's, just be used to a certain thing, a way of doing things. But once you get used to a new way, it's probably going to stick. around. So I guess where I wanted to take your perspective, because you did mention two big effects. One, the winner-takes-all principle will become even more prevalent, right? Kind of the biggest players in a certain market or industry will become even bigger. And then you also mentioned that the need to scale up will likely favor large company to the detriment of smaller ones. Because again, I mean, you have economies and scale and so on. So tell us a little bit about this, because it almost paints a little bit, or at least in my mind, and I might not be understanding it fully, but a little bit of, you know, these big companies will kind of are kind of taking over, and you know, what could startups do? It's almost that question comes to my mind, right, when I read this. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about it.
Okay, with pleasure. Well, the winner-takes-all principle is something that's been analyzed by so many economists that it's hard to know where to start. It's a phenomenon that is probably the byproduct of globalization and technology. You know, everything is visible and accessible. And it's a phenomenon that has particularly developed over the past few years, 10, 20 years. It means essentially that what matters is not the absolute performance, but the relative performance. So the winner takes all rewards the winner. You know, the winner reaps most of the benefits. And you can see that in many different industries. You know, if you are the best footballer in the world, you will twice as much as the second one, even though your marginal advantage is absolutely minimal. It's going to be the same in the music industry, in the computer industry, etc., etc. So it's a trend that very much depends on technology and which favors inequality. So it has its downside. And it's very hard in a global market to understand how you can counter the strengths of this trend. There is very little to do. And again, it's a phenomenon that you can observe everywhere and anywhere, you know, through social influences, etc. So the winner reaps all the benefits. It's happening. You know, at the moment you have one Facebook, you don't have a competitor. You have one Google, you don't have a competitor, etc., etc. So it entails that in industry terms, the big winners are likely to be the largest companies because they benefit from what is absolutely critical to grow, which is network effects. If you are Facebook, you know, how could you possibly imagine they can compete with Facebook? You would need to be a network effects, and it would be almost impossible to do so. So what's happening at the moment, and it's a very critical problem for people who think about, you know, antitrust and monopoly power, etc., is that when you are a startup and a successful startup, particularly in the field of tech, your best hope is to be acquired by a large company. And this is what's happening. You know, all these large tech companies are incredibly cash rich, and they can buy pretty much any startup in the world they like. And you know, it's happening. You can see in the M&A activity. So there are very few startups that grow enough to become behemoths, large companies themselves, because of this phenomenon of scaling up. And in the world of COVID, this goes beyond the realm of tech. If you are small, it's much more difficult to have the capital required to become resilient, to invest in digital assets, in everybody, in everything that's required to grow out of the crisis. So what is obvious at the moment is that the pandemic crisis is benefiting the large companies to the detriment of small companies. And it's something that is, you know, well understood by the financial markets, because at the moment there is a premium attached to being big, to the detriment of being small.
And to kind of create a loop, and also I liked a lot the way that you've structured the book, that you basically the last chapter, you have three big, you know, you have kind of three big different pointers. And the last one is on the individual reset, right? So you spoke on the macro resets, you spoke on the micro resets, and then you speak about the individual reset. And I think that's extremely valuable, because ultimately, you know, it's the question, what can we as individuals do? What can I personally do? What, you know, I guess that's the easiest in our power, right? So I want to take some time to also go a little bit in this chapter of the book, which is about individual reset, and tell us a little bit about what individuals and what we as persons could do, you know, after this COVID-19 situation.
Okay, thank you, with great pleasure. Well, from an individual perspective, you know, COVID has had the effect of forcing us to to think more about the choices we make. You know, crisis, deep crisis, existential crisis like COVID favor introspection. So we just think about, you know, what matters to us more. And of course, the, you know, the engine of the economy is the individual decisions that we make as consumers, as investors. So everything at the end of the day boils down to individual decisions made by, you know, billions of individuals around the world. So the question we ask in the book, I mean, there are several in this individual reset, but for me, a very fundamental question is linked to what economists in the jargon call hysteresis effect. So when our habits change, are they likely to become permanent habits, or will they be abandoned after the crisis passes? And I'll give you an example. Well, several examples. You know, when we went into lockdown, we are forced to work from home. We couldn't fly. We consumed in a very different manner. You know, we bought food, but we didn't buy clothes anymore, or much less of it. So our habits were changing by necessity. And the question we ask in the book is, you know, how much of these are likely to become permanent? Because the consequences in terms of industries will be dramatic. If for example, we decide that working from home is a good thing, the impact this will have on cities, major cities like the one in which you live, Singapore, New York, Paris, London, Shanghai, etc., will be absolutely dramatic. And you know, the mistake we often make is to think that a trend has to be large and massive to be consequential. But in reality, the difference in life is always made at the margin. So if today we estimate that about 30% of people worldwide can work from home, have the privilege of being able to work from home, so they are white collar people. Well, if just a fraction of these people decide to work from home permanently, the impact on real estate prices and commercial real estate, of course, but also, you know, houses and flats will be immense. If we decide that, you know, we are more consciously aware of the necessity to fly less or consume less meat, all things that were epitomized during the pandemic, well, the effect would be absolutely dramatic as well. It may be, for example, that we decide to fly less because, first of all, we realize that there is a very strong correlation between air pollution and COVID. You know, the more air pollution there is, the more likely you are to catch COVID and to die from it as well. So, you know, this consciousness about environmental problems is one thing, but when we realize that the choices we make individually affect the quality of the air we breathe and our susceptibility to become ill, that has a very strong effect. So the last chapter is devoted to exploring these issues and to ponder what the effect on specific industries is likely to be. We don't know yet, because it's still very early on, we're still in the midst of the pandemic, but we've been in this for now 7 months, and we might be in this for many more months, possibly until the end of 2021. So the question is, how will our habits change in a structural, permanent manner after the pandemic passes? And how will it impact industries around the world?
Oh, and I want to add a small example to this. As I was talking to one of our clients who's running a fairly large business in Asia Pacific, and he was sharing that the whole COVID-19 situation basically changed his mind in terms of working from the office. I mean, he realized that by no means is it a must, I guess, for the culture and for the interactions, and because we are human, you know, we are social, you know, kind of social. We have that social element in us. It's not going to be done with no interaction. I think that that's not possible. But his view was that he's probably going to need half the space in the office and make hot desks for everybody, whereas now everybody has a desk. And basically move to a flexible arrangement where it's going to be maybe half the time at home, half the time from the office. So such measures, I also think, I mean, it's a sense, I don't know for sure, I don't know if anybody knows for sure, but I have a strong sense that it's going to be more and more prevalent. I even tried it on my LinkedIn at some point, and I was curious to see what people would respond, and there were quite a lot of responses. I think there were like 2,000 people that voted, and out of the options, right? 5 days from home, 4 days from home, one from the office, and so on, right? Up to 5 days from the office. I think 80% of the people preferred from 3 days at home to the office, 4 days at home, one to the office, or all from home and none at the office. So there's a clear trend and preference towards that. Which indeed, I mean, I think there's even companies in the tech side that I think Twitter, for example, pretty much offered a permanent option to work from home forever.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Facebook as well.
So I just want to end with one, because I do think that you also mentioned in the book, and this has been is not one, I don't think it's often enough talked about, and two, it's a big item also on this individual reset agenda, which is the, how to call it, mental health. And also COVID-19 did, obviously, because of the insecurities, uncertainties, changes, indeed, I think it's also leading to an acceleration of, you know, anxiety or mental problems or mental issues that people have both at work, at home, and so on. So what's your view also on that? Because that's a pretty big topic, and I think a topic that we need to be talking more about.
Absolutely. Well, it's a big elephant in the room, mental health and issues of mental health at work in particular. We observe in the book something which is now totally obvious, but when we wrote it in June, it was maybe less apparent, but there is an explosion of mental health issues related to COVID-19, you know, because people were forced to isolate for weeks, because there is so much anxiety about the future. You know, so many people are anxious about the jobs, about the financial situation. So all these contribute to exacerbating mental health issues. And on top of that, you know, a very simple observation related to working from home, new habits, is that, in fact, it seems to lead to more burnout situations, because people who work from home are unable to differentiate the working life from the personal lives, even though there are many positive aspects, you know, less commuting, more time with the family, etc. So the very, you know, simple point we make is that there is an explosion of mental health problems, and which is now documented in a rigorous manner. In the US, I think it's plus 58% of related cases of mental health caused by COVID, similar numbers in many countries around the world. And so what do we do about them? You know, there is an explosion of websites and apps giving you advice on how to find, become a resilient and how to find more inner peace in front of all this. In my particular case, and this is what the business, the Monthly Barometer and the Summit of Minds have been recommending for years, we take people outside. And one of the, interesting aspects of COVID is that it has reignited the interest for nature. And in fact, nature, being outside, being in the wild, or even being in a park like in Singapore, is an antidote to today's ills. There is a tremendous amount of academic literature showing that being in nature, outside and in nature, you know, among trees, for example, benefits our physical and mental well-being, but also our cognitive capabilities. So what do we do about this? Well, in my particular case, the reason I'm based in Chamonix is precisely this one. You know, we take our clients outside. We take them for a hike. We do board meetings, XCOM meetings in the mountains while hiking, while country skiing, while climbing sometimes. And being outside has a soothing effect. We've known that for thousands of years. And now we understand why. It benefits our mental and physical well-being.
Oh, that's for sure. And I just want to add one example to that I think might help some of our audience as well, that I liked from another client, that on this topic, and I do believe personally that it helps a lot. They organize with the staff open sharing session where they actually encourage the C-level of the company to share some of their struggles and anxieties, and basically in very simple ways, be human, right?
Absolutely.
Be human. Be vulnerable.
Yes, and, right.
Cut the crap. I mean, pardon.
Show empathy. Yeah. Show empathy. That's
exactly. Exactly. We are a little bit, unfortunately, with this age of social media, we are kind of portray the life, a perfect life, or we try to portray it, and others try to portray it, and then we kind of fail to realize that that's you know, you only post the good stuff on your social media. You hardly ever post when you're feeling down, and that's kind of wrong, because it paints the picture that everybody's kind of all the time happy, which it isn't the case. Life is ups and life is downs. So I think we need to, you know, we need to have more of this open discussions and conversations as well, because it helps.
Absolutely.
Super. Well, Thierry, it's been a fantastic sharing session. I really enjoyed it. And thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, Radu. Thank you for having me. It was a great pleasure to be with you.
And I want to, I just want to add my 2 cents on the book to our audience, that basically I started reading it on Saturday and I couldn't let it go. So it's an easy read, but at the same time, it's a very comprehensive read, and it gives a very good overview of many different angles. I was actually sharing with Thierry before we recorded the podcast that whilst I'm personally focused very much on the business front, to be able to think from all the 5 aspects that the book touches on is extremely useful, and it paints a complete picture. So I would recommend everybody to have a read. And Thierry, once again, much, much appreciated your presence with us today.
Well, Radu, thank you so much for having me. It was a great pleasure.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to go to www.elcottglobal.com and click the podcast button for all the show notes of the interview. Also, subscribe to our mailing list to get our latest updates first. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes, Spotify or Stitcher, we would appreciate a kind review. 5-star works best to keep us going and our production team happy. And of course, share it with your friends. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me. And if you have any suggestions on what to do and who to invite next, don't hesitate to drop me a note. And if you're looking to hire top executives in supply chain or transform your business, of course, contact us as well to find out how we can help.